Police Academy is your source for the no apologies, no spin truth about all things police. Discussions about why cops do what they do, avoiding speeding tickets, or just how to stay alive can all be found right here. No questions out of bounds, no topic too sensitive. This is Police Academy. Do you understand
the words that are coming out of my mouth? What we're dealing with here, glittering air, is a complete lack of respect for the law.
And smoke in the reef.
Call the dust pop.
We live in a society of laws.
Dust pop?
Yeah.
No, it's not real.
This thing of weed.
Takes one shot a weekend of training to get that bag.
The only thing that I can remember him really saying was, I'm going to kill you. You're going to die today.
Serving a warrant is just part of the job if you're a cop. It's something that we do without really thinking twice about it most of the time. A lot of them are low-level offenses, things that you expect people won't really put up too much of a fight about, but you always have to expect the unexpected. But in the interview you're about to hear, this was no low-level warrant. First-degree attempted murder is nothing to scoff at, and these officers knew they needed to be on their toes. Unfortunately, for Deputy Mike Hutchinson of Dual County Sheriff's Office, that wasn't enough. Now, if you're a police officer, this story won't affect you too much, I suppose. It might put you to action in a way that could save your future and the future of your families. But if you're a family member, a mom, a wife, a husband, a child of a police officer, I warn you, this might be a little bit disconcerting. You would think we'd take care of our officers who get injured on duty and can't come back to work. But Mike's story is a perfect example of the fact that that's just not the case. At least not always, at least not in the world we live in now. Because Mike isn't the only one this has happened to, and this needs to change. We cannot allow our officers, our public servants, our first responders to risk their lives and then be dumped on the curb when they get hurt doing it. That part of the conversation comes up towards the end. I know it's a long interview, but if you can, stick it out and listen to what has happened to Mike and his family after he was shot 4 times serving this warrant. This should never happen. Thank you guys for listening. Enjoy. I just want to start by letting everyone kind of get an idea of who you are. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your family very briefly, and then we'll get into your law enforcement career.
Okay. Well, I'm a longtime native of Nebraska, graduated from Cozad, Nebraska. Knew I wanted to get in law enforcement, and when I got out of high school, I went into the military. Was in the military for about, just shy of 8 years. Met my wife in Louisiana while I was in the service, and we've been married for, it'll be about 31 years come this July. We have 3 children, Sarah, Molly, and Zach, and they're kind of spread out. Zach lives up in Casper, and Molly's down in Grant, Nebraska with her husband. They own a garage down there, Ride Ride Auto. And my oldest daughter's out in Chicago, and she sells ads for real estate out in Chicago. We have 4 grandchildren. I have 2 granddaughters, Lily and Yael, out in Chicago with Sarah, and two grandsons, Arthur and Everett in Grant, Nebraska. And my son is single, and he works for the Audubon Society out of Wyoming. Been doing law enforcement for approximately 26 to 27 years, closer to 27. And wanted to move closer to this end of the state to be near the grandsons.
Okay. So. Yeah, and I know that you weren't at Dual County. That's the sheriff's office you were with when this happened. You hadn't been there for very long.
No.
What's your experience prior to that? Kind of give us an idea of what your career path was and why. What what made you take the path in life that you did?
Well, most of it, I want to say I had worked at different departments, starting in Lexington and Cozad. And then I went out to Keith County to be the investigator out there for several years. And a friend of mine had recruited to come up to Wayne, and they were hoping to open up an investigator spot, and that didn't happen. And I was invited to come back to Keith County. And so I went back to Keith County and took up my spot as the investigator there. And I moved out east so that we could take care of Carol's mom. I spent a little bit of time, 2 years up in Mitchell as a chief, and then Carol's mom basically developed Alzheimer's, and so we moved further west and ended up out in Merrick and Nance County, and worked out there for a few years. And I reached the rank of sergeant finally out at Butler County.
Okay.
And we decided that since our grandson was growing up in that, and I know the sheriff out in Butler County had passed away, and so we decided that since that was changing hands and stuff, that we wanted to move closer to our grandsons and family back out in western Nebraska. And the sheriff out here knew a friend of mine, and the friend of mine basically recruited me to come out to Dual County. And so Carol and I made a move back out here to Dual County, where we had family and friends, and was hoping to retire here in Dual County.
Okay. And had you had plenty of experience before this happened, December 3rd, 2015, had you ever experienced anything even remotely close to what happened that day?
In my 27 years, approximately, I've only had to draw my weapon a few times. We've had, other high risk arrest warrants that we had done, and, I had trained and that with the group, and been successful in taking down and apprehending suspects, without any shots being fired.
Okay. Before we get into the story, I like to, anytime I interview law enforcement officers, I like to do a quick little speed round and then kind of get a feel for your kind of more individual quirks as far as like how you did your job. So first I'll do a speed round. I'm going to ask you either or questions and just answer them as quickly as you can.
Okay.
All right. Pop or soda?
Soda.
Over or under?
Under.
Pepsi or Coke?
Coke.
Glazed or iced?
Neither one.
Oh, man. Dogs or cats?
Dogs.
Pancakes, waffles, or French toast?
Pancakes.
Star Wars or Star Trek?
Neither one.
Neither one. Superman or Batman?
Batman.
Shoes on or shoes off in the house?
Shoes on.
Pull in or back in when you're parking? And you're headed up to a light. It turns yellow right at the edge of when you have to speed up or slow down. Gas or brake?
Brake.
Okay. All right. Now let's do what I call the cop quiz. What was your threshold for tickets? A lot of officers phrase it as like 10 your mine, or sorry, 10 your fine, 11 your mine. Meaning if you're going 11 over, I'm going to write you a ticket.
If you're 10 over, I'm going to write you the ticket. If you're 9 and under, chances are you're going to get a warning.
Okay. 9, you're fine. 10, you're mine. What was your pet peeve? Or what is your pet peeve? The thing you're most likely to pull someone over with and either tell them the what for or write them a ticket?
Pet peeve would be the long, drawn-out story of why they were doing what they were doing.
Okay, so the excuses for why they got pulled over, pretty much?
If they're short and quirky and it's laughable, I'm good. But some of them get into these long, drawn-out stories. And they're okay. Just like, look, this isn't that big of a deal. I'm just going to, you know.
Okay.
Give you the ticket. Let's move on.
Right.
Because it's a safety. You know, it's a safety hazard for me to be standing out there alongside the road, and more chances of me getting hit if I got to stand there and listen to this guy's life story about something.
Right. Most rewarding moment or event in your career?
Most rewarding. Helping put Charles Lannis Moses in jail.
What was his name? You're kind of breaking up.
Charles Lannis Moses.
Okay.
I helped put him in jail.
Okay.
That was probably the most rewarding.
Why is that?
Well, when I came back to Keith County after being up in Wayne, the county attorney said that they were looking for certain evidence and it wasn't found where Mr. Slodczyk was shot at on his farm. I and the chief deputy went out there, and this was like almost a year later, and we found the shell casing and sent it into the lab, and it came back as the shell casing from Charles Lannis Moses' weapon. And the round that that killed Mr. Slodczyk. So basically it sealed his fate because it had a partial fingerprint, and the primer in the weapon that Mr. Moses was using, basically it was chipped. And so the evidence on that one shell casing helped seal his fate.
Right. But the firing pin was chipped?
Yes.
Okay. Makes sense.
So the primer was basically a fingerprint.
Right. That's awesome. And usually the last question I ask is the worst moment or event in your career. I think it's clear what that moment would have been or is. So let's get into that.
Okay.
So for everyone listening right now, if you're not familiar with this story, Deputy Hutchinson was serving a warrant on Neil Strateski. And the warrant was issued, he had a couple warrants, but the one of concern, obviously, was regarding a first-degree murder charge, and he had violated his bond agreement. That's why the warrant was issued to bring him back in. Did you know the history? Obviously, you knew what the warrant was for. Were you familiar in depth with this guy's history?
No, because I hadn't been there that long in Dual County.
Okay.
I know that the Sheriff Adam Hayward at the time had a couple of dealings with him. And then the information that came back was that there were two warrants for him, one out of Keith County, which is Ogallala, Nebraska, and then the one out of Colorado for attempted murder on his dad with a ball-peen hammer.
Right. So you knew that, you at least knew that he had, the charge was for that hammer incident at the very least.
Yes.
And
yes.
And I assume since hadn't been there for very long, you had not dealt with Mr. Strateski before personally?
No.
Okay.
I hadn't had no personal contact with him at all.
Okay. So real quick, I'm going to run through this guy's history so everyone listening knows. And if you hear something in here that I'm missing or I get wrong, obviously, just stop me and let me know.
Okay.
In 2014, Mr. Strateski was arrested for DUI as well as concealed carry weapon because he had a 9mm in the center console of his truck, which was loaded and with two spare magazines, which in the grand scheme of things is not a huge deal, but that obviously signals to any officer that's going to serve a high-risk warrant like this that he has weapons. He was also issued a warrant when he didn't show up for a driving under suspension ticket. And then in October 2014, the incident took place where he incurred that first-degree attempted murder charge. He was, along with four other people, helping his 90-year-old father move some items around. Do you know where they were? Was it at the father's house, or do you know exactly what they were up to?
No, I don't.
Okay. I didn't find anything. I just know they were helping this gentleman who happened to be Strateski's father, and he became angry over someone moving a freezer. struck a woman on the hand with a hammer and then hit his own father on the top of his head with the hammer. And then he went to his truck, grabbed a rifle, chambered around, and threatened to shoot everyone if they didn't leave. Then he grabs his 90-year-old father, throws him on the ground, and proceeds to punch and kick him in the head and body. And when someone called 911, the sheriff arrived, Randy Peck, and Mr. Strateski pointed the rifle at him twice before he eventually did drop it and was arrested. Did I miss anything in there?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. So, on that initial arrest, his bond was set at $1 million. Eventually, it was reduced to $15,000. Common theme, unfortunately, for officers who put away very dangerous people and sympathetic judges let them go. And then 6 months later, he violated his bond terms and was sent back to jail. This time, the bond was set at $500,000 and eventually lowered to $30,000. And he was eventually able to post that bond and was released as well. Regarding him being released, obviously hindsight is 20/20, but given the information they had at that time, do you think it was a mistake, or do you think the judge in that case was acting, on good conscience, trying to do the right thing? Do you think there were obvious signs that he shouldn't have been released, or do you think that was a reasonable decision at the time?
Okay. This is what everybody fails to understand about bond, okay? Bond is not to keep people in jail. Bond is simply a guarantee that they're going to appear in court, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people get mad about this, and I'm not angry about that. Do I think he should not have got out? He is a danger to society, especially where he's committed an act of violence. And I think that those should be considered, before they go ahead and lower the bond. He's already committed an act, and you have witnesses and you have other victims or multiple victims, then that needs to be considered. Mm-hmm. Before that bond is ever lowered, regardless. But again, bond is not to hold people in jail. It is simply there to guarantee their appearance.
Right.
Okay, and I think that's a fault of our system, and that needs to be looked at.
Agreed. Regarding the what you're getting at is flight risk, basically, and the fact that he had already chosen not to show up for a simple driving under suspension ticket is, you know, kind of, okay, well, he's not showing up to court for a simple traffic ticket. What makes us think he's going to show up for a murder charge?
Correct.
Right? So even under that same argument, I personally question, why are we lowering this guy's bond? He's obviously a threat to the public, but he's also shown that he's not reliable when it comes to showing up for court.
He has a disregard for it.
Right. So he left or was released from jail on that the second time he was put in there on October 22nd, 2015. So that was a little over a month before this warrant was issued and you guys showed up for the warrant service.
Yes.
So we've kind of covered his history. You knew what the warrant was for, but didn't have really in-depth knowledge of his background. And obviously, they didn't have a high-risk warrant team. You're from, you know, you've had experience with other departments serving warrants. What was the process like planning this warrant? What was, if there was one, what was the conversation that you had with your fellow officers and the sheriff before you guys went to this house?
Well, basically, he called everybody to the office there in Big Springs, and even the guys that were off duty, and there was only four of us because it's a small department. The conversation was we wanted to approach Neil about his dog running loose. Well, the dog was running loose that day. I was in Big Springs doing a funeral escort. at the time when I got the call from our sheriff, Scott, and basically wanting everybody to meet at the office. And he explained that Neil had failed to appear on a couple of warrants, one out of Keith County and one out of Colorado. And so we all met there. And of course, Scott is asking, you know, who wants to go to the door? At which time, you know, the other two guys didn't say anything. And I said, well, I guess, you know, I'll go to the door. Now, I'm keeping in mind that, one, my body cam is not on because we share a body cam. We had just gotten these body cams, and it was left at the office because it wasn't all the way in the cradle to be charged because the guy from the night before had used it, and I was on day shift. I figured after the funeral escort, I'd run back and get it, no big deal. So then we're talking about his dog, how we approach, and Scott says, okay, well, you'll go to the door. And
Hold on. I'm not following the dog thing. So was the dog just the kind of the premise for contacting him so he wouldn't suspect you were there to arrest him?
Right.
Okay. Got it.
That was the premise.
That was the cover but story. Okay.
Kind of a weak premise, but that's what he wanted to go with because we've had contact with, if not him, it was his wife, referenced the dog running loose and using the bathroom in the neighbor's yard or whatever, and they were upset about it.
Okay.
But his dog was running loose that day. And even when I was out, after I got the call, I drove by Neil's house and I could see a gentleman standing outside in the backyard. And I assumed that was Neil.
Okay.
And that was relayed to the guys back at the office. This is what I had seen. Well, in hindsight, not trying to armchair quarterback it or go back over it or say what if or anything like that, but those were flags. Those were flags that should have been telling us, hey, you need to be on high alert because this guy's watching.
Yeah.
In fact, his wife was out in her vehicle, and I noticed that she had driven by two or three times. In fact, she got up there, and as I was pulling up into the drive, she jumped out and made a beeline for the house, not on a dead run, but her steps were in a hurry.
Did she park in the driveway or in the street or what?
No, she parked in the driveway. She pulled up in the driveway because I pulled in behind her.
Oh, okay. So she knows that a deputy is pulling in the driveway behind her and just heads straight for the door.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you if she saw me or what, because I found out later that one of the officers that had spoken with her said that they could smell alcohol, strong odor of alcohol coming from her.
Okay, so a whole nother layer going on there. She's
right.
Probably worried about herself more than anything else.
Yeah.
Okay, so was there a plan amongst the four of you going into it as far as, other than Hutch, you're going to the door, was there anything else?
The other three guys were supposed to come up behind me, and once I made contact, they were going to come up and arrest him. But
okay.
Nobody moved to the door.
Right. So the question that I know any officer at this point would ask is, why did you pull into the driveway? And I'm sure you've asked yourself this.
Well, the reason I pulled into the driveway was it's a long ways from the door. I mean, you're talking 20 yards, maybe more, from the door, because you're out by the street, because she didn't pull all the way up into the yard up by the door. She just pulled into the driveway and got out and went in. And my vehicle was probably just a few feet off the street.
Okay. So you felt like you had enough distance between you and the house at that place. Okay.
Right. Keeping my eye on the house and the front of the house, basically the door.
Got it.
So I went into my back seat to get my vest out that I throw on over the top. And I opened the door, and I no more opened the door, and I heard yelling behind me. And I turned around, and there's a shotgun in my face with a gentleman on the end of it that I assume is Neil Strateski. And he's yelling, and I'm trying to tell him I'm there talking about the dog and tell him to put the shotgun down and stuff. And he's basically, I don't remember the conversation totally after everything that had happened. But I got the feeling that, you know, he didn't believe that story and that. So in trying to talk with him and that, the next thing I know, he fired a shot at my feet with a shotgun. And, at that time I noticed he was having problems ejecting the shell. So I grabbed the barrel and, part of the buttstock, and I swung it around and hit him upside the head with the buttstock and yanked. And as I yanked, he shoved and I fell backwards. When I fell backwards, that's when I hit my head. And the next thing I feel is I feel a sharp pain in my left buttocks cheek, and it was burning. And, after that, it was hard to focus or concentrate on anything. And I know I ended up like face down behind my car.
Okay.
After that, I couldn't tell you what happened other than, I know Scott got to me. And when he turned me over, I was explaining to him, you know, that he shot me in the ass. And, you know, everything else was just kind of numb. And the guys were talking to me, and they got the medical staff there, the EMTs and that from Big Springs, and they got there. But they were all at the church that I was doing the funeral escort at, and they were there, I want to say, within inside of 3 minutes.
Which is really good, considering a volunteer department like that.
God was with me that day because everything just fell into place. Within 9 minutes, I was on Highway 30. Normally, they take you to the nearest hospital. But somebody from Ogallala said that they had two paramedics standing by and asked if they wanted them, and they said yes. So they met the ambulance in Brule, which time the paramedic got on. And they took me on to Ogallala, and that's where Dr. Banks did the surgery, basically, that probably saved my life. And he said if the paramedic hadn't done what he did, you know, the lights would have been, everything would have been over. But the paramedic did what he did. Dr. Banks was a combat surgeon. He was with Navy SEAL Team 10 over in Afghanistan, and he ended up in Ogallala in 2013. But anyway, he did to keep me alive. And then I guess they called for a helicopter, but three of them showed up because other people called for helicopters. And one group didn't have what the helicopter I was going on didn't have what they needed for me, but the other crews did and gave the equipment they had to them. And then they got me off to Colorado.
Wow.
So
what was the surgery? What did they have to do initially at Ogallala that saved your life? You were shot four times.
Yes. I didn't know that until after I came to in the hospital up in Colorado.
Right.
I thought I was only shot once, but when I woke up, my wife was talking to me. She said I was shot four times, and I'm like, what?
And two of them were kind of upper chest, one left, one right, correct? And then you had abdomen, geez, and in your leg, which ricocheted into your pelvis. Is that
correct?
Right?
Correct.
So what were they working on that initially that saved your life?
Basically, stopped the major part of the bleeding and, blood transfusions.
Okay.
So he got the bleeding stopped in that. My understanding from later on talking with, a surgeon up in Colorado, they said that, later that night, my blood pressure started dropping and they pulled me back in for more surgery. And that they found that they had to remove my spleen because that's where a lot of the bleeding was occurring. So my spleen was removed. My large and low and small, my large and small intestine, I've had both of them removed. My liver, bladder, stomach was hit. I think that was everything.
You're missing some seriously important parts.
Yes.
So how, What does that mean for life right now?
Well, with the CAT scans and everything I have a higher risk of getting cancer. I have to be careful who I'm around, because if I get sick and start running a fever, I'm supposed to go immediately to the emergency room. So my immune system has been compromised.
Okay.
And then with the CAT scans that I've had, my chance of cancer is very, very high.
Right. When you were, let me step back a minute. When he came out with the shotgun and you were face to face with him, still trying to, you know, hopefully talk him down under that loose dog premise, do you remember what that conversation was like? How that went?
Like I said, I was trying to get him to calm down. And the only thing that I can remember him really saying was, "I'm going to kill you. You're going to die today."
And what were you thinking when he said that?
Well, I was kind of saying my prayers. "Lord, if this is my day, please forgive me for my sins." And help me out here. So he did. He helped me out.
Yeah, probably not exactly in the way that you were hoping for at that moment. He still got shot, right? But
yeah,
you know, you walked away with your life, and it sounds like you're grateful, and I'm sure your wife and kids and grandkids are grateful for that. So
yes, they are.
I've been, you know, doing research before this interview, watching some of your news interviews and just reading articles, and you, in one of those, you say that your core was the most affected. And that's been a difficult part of the recovery. How is your recovery going? Where are you at now?
Well, I've kind of hit a plateau. One thing they did, you get about 3 layers of abdomen muscles, and they cut 2 of mine out, and they told me that, basically, the muscle that's in my core on my stomach is enough to stabilize me while I'm walking and hold my organs in. And I'm on a lifting restriction of no more than 10 pounds right now. And that for the rest of my life, I'm not to lift any more than 50 pounds, because if I do, I can tear that muscle in there, and I'll be right back in on an operating table and them sewing me up again.
Mm-hmm. So the next question I had was what the road looks like ahead. And part of that is, are you going back? And I feel like from what you're telling me, the answer is a resounding no.
Doctors are recommending no.
As if you're under those kinds of restrictions, you know, unless you're in a position where you're never going to fight with somebody or chase someone.
Yeah.
You know, how can you perform your role effectively?
Yeah.
So what does the road look like in the near future as far as your recovery, and, you know, what are your plans as far as, you know, barring any serious health concerns, you know, you are able to stay healthy? What are your plans going forward?
Well, basically to take one day at a time. I've still got nerve issues, back issues. So I'm still working physical therapy. They told me that, you know, I needed to see some counseling due to the post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm doing that. As far as work, I'm hoping that there's something out there that I can do that, you know, that, I can support I and my wife with, and go on with life and move ahead. I don't want to be, I don't want a bunch of sympathy, and I don't want, I don't want to be bitter, because if I'm bitter, I'll end up like old Stratesky over there. And I'm definitely not a bitter person. So I feel that, I'm blessed, and, what I have is good. So I just need to take one day at a time and, keep praying that the Lord will be there with me each and every day.
Mike, that's a wise p- position to take considering what you've gone through and, you know, how you could react to a situation like this. Obviously, yeah. You've got plenty to be bitter about. And one of those things that I've read significant amount about, it's been pretty big in the news locally, even here in Omaha, is the fact that your insurance was canceled after this happened by, at the time it was Blue Cross. They dropped your insurance. And yep. when you went to the county and said, hey, you know, are you guys going to take care of me? Go ahead.
What about your commitment that your sheriff told me that day? If I came to work for you, this was your commitment. And nobody said, oh, by the way, if you get hurt on the job and you can't work, we're going to take your life insurance, your health insurance, your retirement, and your vacation. We're going to take all that away because you're hurt. You got hurt while working for us, but this is what we're going to do for you. We're going to take all this from you.
Right.
And it's not right.
No, and it's not. And that's, there was a quote in one of these articles from the county attorney, Joel Jay, that said, basically, there's no legal contractual obligation to provide insurance because tax dollars would have to pay for your insurance. And I read that, and I just, having been in, you know, in many ways, the same uniform you were, I cannot wrap my mind around how this is even a question. It doesn't, in my opinion, matter, as if my opinion matters, but it doesn't matter if there's a written agreement that if you get hurt on duty, they're going to do this, that, and the other for you. There's a moral obligation there that I think trumps any sort of legal agreements. Clearly, if the tax dollars that paid for your uniform, and I'll say this because I don't want you to have to go on this rant, but any officer would resoundingly agree with what I'm saying and what I know you agree with here. The tax dollars that paid for your uniform, that paid for the cruiser you drove, that paid your salary, your time off, all of that stuff, and your insurance, those same tax dollars are also the ones that funded you walking into that situation, the taxpayers that you're protecting, you know, they're paying those taxes so that people like you will go do that job because, quite frankly, they don't want to. And the fact that you got hurt, you were shot four times and have literally lost in many ways your entire way of life. The fact that you are now unable to work more than, 30 hours a week,
right,
should have nothing to do with whether tax dollars can pay for your medical bills from here on out.
Right.
You should be covered for the rest of your days. You know,
yes.
Say you live to 90 years old and die a natural death. They should be covering those medical bills that are related to, especially the ones that are related, but if you're unable to work because of this injury, they should be covering that.
Yes.
I mean, we see this with veterans, obviously, the same kinds of issues. And it's interesting because I don't know of any stories, any big stories in like national media, for example, that talk about this with law enforcement. But I think it's more common than not, because with my department, we had the same issue. I remember it coming up at some point where we realized that if one of our officers were seriously injured on duty and couldn't come back to work in a certain number of hours, that we would lose everything that you did, all of our benefits, our insurance coverage, work comp, everything. It'd be gone.
Yep.
Which makes no sense at all.
None.
So where are you at currently with this? Is it, because I know for a while you guys were going back and forth with the county. They were kind of on the fence. Are we going to pay for this or not? What has come of this disagreement?
Well, basically the county issued a one-time stipend of $1,500. After they took taxes and everything out, it came to about $1,100 and some dollars. and we had to go out and get our insurance off of Obama's health care plan. So that's what we're doing right now.
And I know in one of the articles I read, the COBRA payment would have been $1,500 a month. So that stipend correct. Wouldn't even cover 1 month. And I assume, considering what Obamacare has done to insurance plans, that your monthly payment right now for at least you and your wife is right up there too. So they gave you a stipend that probably doesn't even cover entire month's health care.
Well, actually, it was $144, but it's going to go up to about $177 after the first of the year.
That's your monthly premium?
But, yeah, that's the monthly premium.
Okay. That's extremely low, but that $1,100 isn't going to take you very far.
No, it's not.
That is offensive to me, just being honest.
It's very offensive. Here's something. We don't have to reinvent the wheel, because I know for a fact that this has happened across the state of Nebraska. There are other agencies that I worked for, okay, that I know of, where officers were injured, okay, and they were out for a year or maybe a little bit more. In fact, a good friend of mine that I worked with out in Merrick County, he was injured in a rollover accident while going after a suspect in a pursuit. I believe the individual was drunk. Anyway, the officer rolled his vehicle and was out and had to have surgery. The sheriff went to the county commissioners and said, hey, he's still got a family. He's still got kids. He's still got bills to pay. What I'd like to do is I'd like to take his workman's comp check, put it over here into the general fund or whatever it is that they pay the officers out of, and then kick him a check and just keep his benefits intact. And they did that. They did that for that officer.
Mm-hmm.
I had a sheriff from another county, a neighboring county, come to me and said, Hutch, this is what we do. We take the workman's comp check, we put it over here, we issue him a check, and he doesn't lose his benefits.
Right. So
So this has happened in the state of Nebraska now.
Right. People have provided you and Dual County with examples and templates of how to handle something like this.
No, nobody in Dual County has.
No, that's what I mean. These other counties have done it,
right.
and Dual County can see that.
Yes.
And
yes.
So what is interesting to me, and the big question is, regardless of what the red tape says, why was the decision made not to support you as one of their employees? And go, okay, obviously we have a problem, because this is a problem on Dual County's part. And rather than just allowing the Hutchinson family to suffer because we didn't have this lined up ahead of time, let's fix it now in the process of this situation and then fix it on paper for the future. I don't understand why that isn't the course of action versus just saying, well, it's not in ink, so we're not going to do anything for you.
I don't know. I've heard a couple of different theories. They were mad because I had hired an attorney, and he was from the neighboring county. I heard they were upset about that. I was told that after my daughter had gone on Facebook and encouraged people to call and have the county commissioners do the right thing. Some people called and threatened the county commissioners, and they blamed that on me and my family. And we didn't ask for anybody to call and threaten anybody. All we did was ask them to call and encourage the county commissioners to do the right thing.
Right, and that's if they're in an elected office. That's how it's supposed to work.
Right. They were mad because their phone numbers were put on social media for people to call, but they're county commissioners and they get calls from,
their phone number should be public.
Right. Right.
Interesting.
Yes.
So I don't know. I would hope that the citizens of that county would not reelect those people. But aside from that, what can officers, anyone, any police officers listening, I know there are a few that are getting into law enforcement with, you know, new departments for them. What can those people, those officers do to make sure that they don't end up going through the same thing you did?
Well, and this is not only for law enforcement, but for first responders anywhere.
Good point.
And here's another thing that's going to come up. You got volunteers for fire departments in smaller rural communities than that.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be asking their employers, if I get hurt and am not allowed to come back to my job for a year, do I still have a job? Are my benefits intact? You know, what's going to happen? Do I lose my entire benefit package? They need to know those things up front. And I think it needs to be mandated that before that person signs on with the company or signs on with a department or organization, that that is put up front and foremost. By the way, if you get hurt on the job, this is what's going to happen.
Right.
Had I known what Dual County was going to do if I got hurt, I would have told them they would have to find another officer because I wouldn't agree to that. I have a family to take care of, and I will not work for a department that isn't going to look after me after I'm out there risking my neck to save you folks.
Right. And it's not about, obviously, the civilians that you're literally protecting. You know, it's about the employer. It is a profession just like anyone else, any other, where you have to, this is a case in point, you've got to have that stuff on paper. And going into a department that doesn't have that taken care of is like joining the military, becoming that Navy SEAL, and knowing that if you get injured, and if you're a SEAL, that's your chances are much higher than most professions. Knowing that you get injured and can't fight anymore, they're just going to dump you at the curb and pay for your bus ticket. Not very many people would be signing up.
No.
Unfortunately, I think you're right. Because you didn't know this would or could have been an issue. I didn't. My entire department, the union didn't have a clue that we were missing this in our contract. And I think it's probably very common. Do you know if there are any efforts nationally to fix this? And let me start by putting this caveat that I tend to be, I prefer government to not be involved with most things, but our government is extremely hands-on with a lot of things socially and in our work environment, requiring mandates and whatnot. Why on earth do we not have a federal mandate that requires, as you said, any employer that employs first responders and police officers in positions where they are, you know, likely to get hurt to where they're not going to be able to continue to work? Why do we not have a federal mandate that requires those employers to cover them and take care of them after they get hurt? That doesn't make any sense.
No, none whatsoever.
Do you know if there are any efforts in that direction?
Not to my knowledge, but I can tell you this. It is starting to come to the forefront because I have read articles on social media about even past officers that have been hurt and cannot return to work, and that these officers are not being looked after, and there's no help out there for them at all.
Right.
So they've sacrificed, but nobody else is out there to give them a helping or lending hand. You know, so how does a guy not be able to provide for his family, and he's already sacrificed, again, like our veterans? You know, there's money for bringing refugees over and stuff like that, and our veterans are out there on the street. You know, there's no help. And the same now with our law enforcement. It is starting to come to the forefront. But any young law enforcement officer, you need to sit down and say, I want to know if I get hurt, what is the department, what is their responsibility? Show me your SOP manuals. Show me where it says, if I get hurt, what happens to me? I want to see it in writing. If you can't provide that, I'm not signing with your department.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the key thing is, if you get hurt and you get hurt bad enough that you can't come back and work at all or enough hours, what do they require to continue to provide benefits? That's what you have to look at, because they'll cover you if you can work light duty, part-time, whatever it is in a lot of cases. But if you can't come back, are they just going to dump you on the side of the road? That's what you have to look at.
Yeah.
And no one told me that. Like I said, in my department, they were figuring that out while I was there. No one told you that. Yeah. You'd been in for 25 years, 26 years when you were injured. So it's something I think we've neglected and hasn't been an issue until more recently. I don't know if it's because, you know, these stories are just easier to access now, or maybe we just, aside from the ink, places took care of people because it was the right thing to do in the past, and we're not doing that anymore. I don't know.
Here's something else that people probably don't know. Keith County had a county commissioner die, and the other county commissioners voted to pay the Cobra for X amount of months for the family until they could get insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't even a guy that put his life on the line. He was just a commissioner that had a health issue and he passed away, but yet he still had a family.
Right.
Okay. And the commissioners at that time, so they have the power to go ahead and say, okay, this is what we're going to do.
Interesting. I wonder, how long had you been with Duel? It was only,
let's see.
It's like a little over a year, wasn't it?
Yep. A little over a year. It would have been a year in October.
So I can't help but wonder, had you been a 25-year officer at that department, how different the response would have been? Having that long-term relationship, a deeper relationship with that department, in that community, the county there, I can't help but wonder. And obviously we can only speculate, but it just is so odd. But again, I guess it's not, considering it all involves human beings that are emotional and make decisions based on emotion, not logic and reason. How different the response could have been had you been there for a lot longer. But considering that the county doesn't want to support you or neglects to, how can my listeners support you if, you know, they want to help in whatever way, whether it's donating or just sending you, you know, their thoughts and prayers? How can they get a hold of you? How can they help?
Well, they can get a hold of me through anylawdog@gmail.com. The Prayers for Deputy Hutchinson page on social media, Facebook. We're having a survivor party in Grant, Nebraska at the fairgrounds December 2nd, starting at 6 p.m. If anybody would like to come out, they're sure welcome to.
Where was that again? Fairgrounds where?
Fairgrounds in Grant, Nebraska, Perkins County.
Okay.
My wife and my daughter decided to do this, and they're putting it on. And so that's on the prayers page also. But December 2nd,
okay,
6 o'clock, Perkins County Fairgrounds in Grant, Nebraska.
All right. And for everyone listening, as usual, I will put all of those links and that information in the show notes. So if you want to send Mike something and see how you can help, you can find those in the show notes. Don't worry about writing them down and getting in a wreck if you're driving or something.
Okay. All right. Appreciate it.
Mike, I just want to say thank you for your 26, 27 years of service.
Thank you.
obviously I'm not responsible for what course of action your employer and the county there has taken, but you know, I hate apologizing for something I have no control over, but I'm so sorry that you found yourself in the situation that you're in. That should never happen. I'm definitely going to, this has definitely scratched the surface for me as far as understanding this problem, and I'll be looking more into it. Hopefully, maybe I'll be able to see who is trying to make a change there and help somehow, because this should just never happen. But thank you for your service. I think more importantly, thank you for not giving up. I think you're probably a hero to more people than you know. You're an example to the younger generations, to everyone around you, that whatever life throws at you, there's still hope, and don't give up. So thank you for doing that. And thank you. We've been on the phone for over an hour. So thank you for spending the time with me and my audience.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it
You're
so
welcome.
Much.
You're welcome.
That's a wrap for this one, ladies and gents. As usual, thank you for listening. I'm only going to ask one thing from this episode, and that is you share it and tell whoever you share it with to make sure they listen to the conversation 38 minutes in. That's about the insurance that applies to everyone in this country, because if you're a civilian, you should want your officers to be taken care of, because they're out there sticking their necks out for you every day. And if you're a police officer, you better make darn sure your department is going to take care of you if you get hurt on duty. And if they're not, you better fix it. And if they're not going to fix it, go find a new department, because any department that's not going to take care of their officers when they get hurt doing their job isn't worth working for. It's just not worth it. Yes, you signed up to be a cop. That means you might get killed. It means you might get hurt. But the commitment you make should be reciprocated by a commitment to take care of you if you get hurt. The last thing I want to say is I bumped this interview up a week in release date so that if anyone is near Grant, Nebraska, you would be able to make it to that survivor party. That's on December 2nd at 6 p.m. Grant, Nebraska. And again, I will put the contact info for Mike in the show notes, but you can email him at N-E, that's Nora Edward, Law, L-A-W, Dog, D-O-G, that's N-E, Law Dog, at gmail.com, and you can find him on Facebook at the Prayers for Deputy Hutchinson page. You can get a hold of him there and find out how you can help. If it's only a word of encouragement, I'm sure he'll appreciate it. I'm sure the family would appreciate any donations if you are able and willing, but you can find out how to do that by contacting Mike through one of those two ways. And that's it. That's all I've got for this one, guys. Thanks for listening, and thank you for helping bring some awareness to this issue that our law enforcement system in America needs to fix. I will see you all next Thursday, where I'm talking with University of Louisville professor Justin Nix about the Ferguson effect, implicit racial bias, and all that kind of fun stuff. So stay tuned for that. As always, do good, be strong, fear nothing. This is Police Academy.